Well, you might know the new James Bond film, Quantum of Solace, is to be released later in the year. And for a second time, Daniel Craig plays the 007 spy. And debate rages in some quarters as to whether Daniel Craig really is a more gorgeous Bond than the quintessential man of sex appeal, Sean Connery. I think my verdict is that it's deuce, actually. But for many, of course, the James Bond character is the embodiment of male glamour. Seductive, in control, fashionable, aloof. Well, my next guest has taken a step back from the endless tittle-tattle of gossip columns about glamour ratings to write a fascinating history of glamour. And why, from Lord Byron to James Bond to Ava Gardner to J-Lo, some people and characters seem to hold great fascination for the public. Stephen Gundle is the author of Glamour, A History. He's also Professor of Film and Television Studies at Warwick University in the UK. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Good morning, Geraldine.
And you really have a story of contradictions here, which is why it's so challenging. You say that glamour is neither beauty nor elegance, but rather an unsettling, unholy blend of class and sleaze that defies elitist notions of decorum and good taste. Has it always been thus, or is that a very modern version of glamour?
No, I actually think it's always been just like that. I think there is a lot of confusion about what glamour is and where it comes from. And I wrote the book really to try and understand myself in the first instance what the answers to these questions were. And my view is that glamour has always been a hybrid. It's always worked to seduce, above all, seduce the eye with glittering and exciting images that have rested on certain qualities. Beauty is one of them, but normally artificial beauty. Wealth is another. Sex appeal is important. So is celebrity, and so too is movement. And I think the way these things have combined to work their seductive effect has been by relying on a series of contradictions, the classy and the sleazy, if you like.
But what do you mean by movement, by the way?
Exclusive.
What do you mean by movement?
Well, movement, travel. I mean, I think typically the glamorous person will be deracinated. You know, they won't be linked to a particular place. They won't have a stable position in a given hierarchy. Typically, they're outsiders who've made themselves, who've invented themselves, and have a strong image which appeals to a broader audience. So the glamorous person is often nomadic. They'll be moving between continents, going to the watering holes, the great resorts frequented by the rich and the famous. And this works to dazzle the rest of us and make their lifestyle seem very attractive and appealing.
A la Mick Jagger, I suppose.
Well, exactly. I mean, I argue that glamorous people are mostly women, but there are certainly glamorous men, and men have led lots of glamorous lifestyles. Mick Jagger's lifestyle, of course, is exceptionally enviable, and the rock star lifestyle in general.
I'm not sure it is, actually, Stephen, but I'm amazed he's still alive, along with all of them. But
well, I think he's kept very good care of himself. Mm. Richard is another matter, but you know, I mean, he's much more of a sort of outsider rebel. But Mick Jagger always embraced the British aristocracy, the opulent lifestyle, the international resorts. You know, he married a socialite, Bianca, of course, his wife from the 1670s, and not to mention Jerry Hall.
Not quite. I mean, she was distinctly glamorous. I interviewed her 20 years ago, and I tell you, I'd rarely met a more glamorous person. But she clearly traded very much on mixed glamour as well. So this was a sort of a tandem glamour act, wasn't it?
Well, I think, you know, it's sometimes said that in the world of celebrity and show business, 1 + 1 = 3, because you've got the two people who belong to the couple, and then you've got the couple. So the publicity effect, the glamour effect, if you like, is enhanced by their being together.
Look, neither monarchy nor the aristocracy, though, you say, were the principal originator or social bearer of glamour. So when did this start, then?
Well, I made this point because the term glamour is very often used to describe royalty. Historians use it to describe the royals of the past. You know, even Louis XIV or Marie Antoinette, the term is frequently used in studies of these figures. My view is no, glamour belongs to the modern era, belongs to a modern, fluid, changing society. And the first real figure of glamour is not Marie Antoinette, but Napoleon. And the difference is that Napoleon's court was centered on the city of Paris. It was much more open. It was meritocratic. It drew in all sorts of people. It was flashy and ostentatious. Marie Antoinette, although she had an interest in fashion and in some respects seems like a glamorous figure, was, of course, enclosed in the court at Versailles. She was not on view to the masses. She was not envied by the masses, who actually hated her and, of course, held her responsible for the economic crisis that led to the revolution. Napoleon is a self-made man from the backwaters of Corsica, a minor aristocrat, but fundamentally an outsider who turned himself into an emperor and surrounded himself with this magnificence and opulence, which was very material and which, in effect, anybody could buy into, at least in the level on the level of imagination.
So it only comes about, you're proposing, when you turn upside down fixed hierarchies, although I think your book is essentially saying, but this is where I'm very interesting, that it creates another set of hierarchies. They're just implicit, they're subtle. We don't fully recognise that it's creating another set of hierarchies.
Yes, I mean, this is obviously simplifying, but let's say in aristocratic society, you've got a rigid social hierarchy. You can be at the top of that hierarchy only if you're born into it. In modern society, of course, hierarchies are a bit more fluid than that, and it's possible to have social mobility up and down. Nonetheless, there is a hierarchy. But glamour, I think, is a product of the modern hierarchy, and it serves in a way to mask the element of rigidity in that hierarchy, because it's thrust to the fore people who are incredibly appealing and who the majority of us can connect to. I think there are an awful lot of glamorous figures, if we look at them over the last two centuries, who have come from rather humble origins. They have that common touch, even though they are living splendid and expensive and enviable lifestyles. And I think in that way, glamour does serve to mask real inequalities, and not by chance. I mean, it flourished most during the Great Depression of the 1930s. I mean, it was an escape. It was a way in which people coped with the crisis. They could have rebelled. They could have staged a revolution or something, but they didn't. They went to the movies instead.
So this is when Greta Garbo, of course, people like Greta Garbo, Marlene Dietrich, started to come to the fore in the aftermath of those times.
These were all, of course, women who, although they had some particular qualities, were fundamentally ordinary, who grew up in not very exciting or interesting circumstances, who were deemed by the movie moguls, the great Hollywood film industry in the 1930s, to have some quality that would render them especially attractive to the masses. And I think by that time, the 1930s, glamour had become a corporate product. There were people who understood exactly how to manufacture it. It wasn't left to chance or left to the individual anymore. It became a system.
My guest on Saturday Extra here on ABC Radio National is Stephen Gundell, and he's had the very clever idea of compiling the history of glamour by way of charting our modern world. Look, I want to take issue with you about whether you're confusing celebrity with glamour, because you have quite a lot of discussion about the old posh spice, Victoria Beckham, in your book, and what she represents. And I thought to myself, no, she's just a celebrity. She's not glamorous. Like, I don't think Paris Hilton is glamorous. I think David Beckham is glamorous, but not his wife. So help me think that through.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to say that who is glamorous depends on our subjective viewpoint. Of course, there are industries and specialists who are grooming figures and presenting them to us in the hope that we will find them glamorous. Whether it works or not depends on our particular culture and position and background and preferences. And it's true that Victoria Beckham is not a figure who has a lot of personal style. I mean, she's not remotely mysterious, but I think she is in a way an embodiment of the collective dreams, not of everybody, but certainly of a lot of young women.
I would have thought Gwyneth Paltrow fitted your bill, but not Victoria Beckham. Similarly, I mean, it's like looking at Princess Margaret and the Queen. Princess Margaret had glamour. The Queen never did. That's got nothing to do with my level of respect for either woman.
Let me disagree with you, Geraldine. I mean, I think the point is, I agree with you absolutely about the Queen and Princess Margaret. I mean, the reason Princess Margaret is, or was, glamorous is because she stepped outside of the conventional frame of royalty. She did unconventional things, and she had sex appeal. Royalty almost never has sex appeal. Even Princess Diana, if you think, who is a royal who had sex appeal, it was only when she stepped outside the frame of convention that she became appealing. She entered the realm of glamour. It was only when she made herself over following the breakdown in her marriage that she emerged, I think, as a compelling and fascinating figure who became a media personality. Now, I would say, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow is, you know, a great actress, has a certain appeal, but she doesn't live an overtly opulent lifestyle. And I think celebrity is about fame, and fame is just one constituent of glamour. The other important one is wealth.
Okay, well, we'll see what the listeners think about this, because I would have thought Marlene Dietrich deliberately rationed herself. That's why she remained so enduringly glamorous. She wasn't available all the time. That was part of it, you know?
That's right, although the Hollywood stars were always sold as imitable. People could dream about them, and they could buy into their lifestyle, sometimes by buying sponsored products, certainly reading about them, collecting photos, and so on. I think in the 1930s and 40s, the Hollywood studios could ration the appearances of the stars much more than is possible today. I mean, today the mass media are far more diversified, there are far more of them, and the chances of sort of being remote and mysterious are much more limited. I think in that sense, one can talk about a significant change and possibly even some sort of decline in glamour as it was understood, say, 60, 70 years ago.
Is there a difference, Stephen, between Hollywood and European glamour?
Well, it's not always easy to distinguish the two because, of course, Europe absorbed Hollywood, and one could also say that Hollywood, in its own way, absorbed Europe. I mean, Hollywood was made by Europeans to a large extent. But I think what the Americans did in the 1930s, I mean, through Hollywood, was to really render glamour a mass product. And I think in European glamour, the class element often was a bit more pronounced than the down-to-earth, sleazy element.
Mm.
And I think it was Hollywood that blended the two and gave it this fantastic mass dimension that the Europeans on their own would never have reached.
And look, why are they very rarely powerful at the same time? You make that point that the glamorous elite, despite their prominence, don't generally hold, any political power or institutional role.
No, I think it's because, generally speaking, we expect different things from our politicians. We don't expect our politicians to lead enviable lifestyles, typical lifestyles. We prefer them to be down to earth and rooted, not rootless and nomadic. We prefer our politicians, perhaps, generally speaking, to have substance. And, of course, politicians are generally men of a certain age, whereas figures of glamour are often women who are somewhat younger, typically. And I think, you know, the way the two are different, I think, tells us something about the way our society functions and holds together. That there's a division of roles, a division of purposes, and the political sphere, the sphere of power, runs in one way, and the forms of social integration, driving consumption and so on, function in a different way.
Look, it's really so thought-provoking, and I know that our listeners, I'm going to invite them to let us know what they think. Thank you so much for this great challenge to our preconceptions about glamour.
My pleasure, Geraldine. I've enjoyed it.
And Stephen Gundel's book is Glamour, A History, and the publisher is Oxford University Press. And Humphrey McQueen, after I spoke about that we were going to talk about glamour on with Fran Kelly yesterday morning, Humphrey McQueen, the great Australian historian, wrote into us Your promotion led to me to suggest my article on glamour in Australia in the 20th century on my website. I suggest you scroll to Australian history and then to fancy work. The nitty gritty is a few pages in. So look, go and have some fun with Humphrey McQueen this weekend.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.